Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests in all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is Paul Scanlon. This has definitely been one of my favorite conversations, definitely in the top three or four conversations that I've had on this podcast in recent years. Paul has an incredible outlook in terms of mindset, and what you may notice, and I will just say this at the beginning, Paul's mic wouldn't work, and we're obviously recording this remotely due to COVID. So the sound kind of comes in and out, but I'm hoping my editor, Tommy, will be able to kind of do some wizardry on that. But the sound quality is a little bit lower on his side than normal just because of the microphone. It's not a problem, but I'm a little bit of a all about my sound quality. So you may notice that in the beginning. But the value in today's podcast is absolutely incredible. Some of the things we talked about, how labels can become our identities and how to watch out for that, how to change your identity through repetition. So if you're in an echo chamber and your identity is wrapped up into, you know, the way that you look or your job or whatever it is you're doing, if that's no longer helping you and serving you by making you unhappy every time that belief is challenged or that identity is challenged, how to let go of that, how to develop getting back up skills when life knocks you down, the power of reframing and how that is a superpower and why it's okay to outgrow people. There's so much in today's podcast. I'm going to be listening back to this one myself. It was like a mini therapy session for me, very similar to when I had Marble Cats on the podcast. So I'll be going back over this one myself. Paul's content's incredible, and this is just an inside look into changing your mindset and rewiring your mindset and considering and asking some questions that can potentially have a very positive impact on your life, regardless of your goal, whether that's fulfillment, improving your fulfillment levels in your job, whether that's your weight loss or body compositional goal, or just trying to be happier and more fulfilled and peaceful in your mind so you're not dealing with anxiety and stress and worry all the time. This, as I said, one of the most enjoyable conversations I've had in a long time, and I've had some fantastic guests, but in terms of personal, what I got from this episode, it's high up there on that list. So enjoy today's episode with Paul Scanlon on the art of unlearning, developing get back up skills when life gets difficult, and why it's okay to outgrow people. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Paul Scanlon. Paul has trained and mentored people for over 30 years as a keynote speaker all over the world. After 3 decades in the not-for-profit sector, Paul has successfully transitioned and reinvented as an educator through both his live and online masterclass events in communication, leadership, and personal development. Paul's 3 strands of focus are communication, leadership, and human flourishing. His hallmark is making complex things simple. Paul passionately believes it's more important to grow people than things, and he believes that there's greatness in everyone and knows the most need help of a well-chosen coach or mentor to discover it. He's also the host of the Growing Big People with Paul Scanlon podcast. I'm looking forward to diving into all things mindset and personal development in today's episode. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
How are you, Brian? It's always strange listening to someone read your own bio.
Isn't it just like anytime I'm ever on a podcast and I hear it back, I'm like, that sounds like it's somebody else.
It's like, oh, I wrote that about myself. I don't know how I feel about that.
It's crazy. But it happens with everybody. Paul, I'm really excited to chat because you have a fantastic approach towards mindset, towards personal development that I think my audience are going to get so much value from. But before we dive into that, can you talk a little bit about your backstory and what kind of got you into kind of your role in mentorships and leadership and personal development in general?
Yeah, I think as you said in the bio, I had 30 years in not-for-profit. And I think I realized in my case, coming from a background in charity sector, church world, speaking into these settings, leading in some of these settings, I realized that we were very limited in our approach to how we viewed ourselves and other people. I realized that our human experience, really generally in much of the sector I was in, was very limited, and our worldview and our understanding of our own humanity was limited. And I myself, I think, got so stuck at stages of my life. And I think my stuckness, looking back, was due to my limited understanding of what a human being needs to flourish. So it set me on this a search for what that meant for me and what it meant for us as human beings. And I began a journey about, 25 years ago, I think, that's brought me to where I am now, of much more being focused on a holistic approach to myself and to all of us as humans. And then when I did my events around the world, as you mentioned, I factored that in hugely to everything I spoke about, whether it was a communication masterclass I did teaching public speaking, which I've done for over 40 years, or whether it was personal development and life skills, team building, cultural engineering, wherever it was, that holistic approach that I know you're very committed to yourself made a huge difference to my mindset about me. I began to get better and flourish in a more balanced way as a person. And I felt what I contributed was safer and more balanced and more thought through than the lopsided approach, I think, and many still have, to what we humans need to flourish and do well and thrive in life.
What's an example of the lopsided approach?
I think focusing on one part of your humanity, and in my case, in the not-for-profit and the church world, it was very much spiritual, or should I say religious. And I think focusing on that version of you and building your identity around one expression of you and the labels that are attached to that is, I think, where people get stuck. And I think we get boxed into a tribal identity or a racial identity or a social class identity or an interest identity or a group identity. And all of those things we think are large, but actually they're very small when you step back and realize how big life is and how much more there is to being a flourishing, open-minded human. So I think I got stuck inside a ghetto mentality. But I think the thing is, when you are trapped in a ghetto, exclusive group mentality, whatever that may be, so it creates this echo chamber and this bubble that many of us live in life, never aware that we are stuck in an echo chamber of people like us who just feed back to us and echo back to us what we're already thinking. And because that's our world, we think that that's all the world is. And for me, I got trapped in a religious world, I think, with all the trappings of that. And I think I had to break free from that, as I said, 20 odd years ago, which was very radical and very upsetting, I think, to me and to those that were following me, because I had massive personal reinventions around the things we're talking about, which meant my worldview changed, my framing of things changed. But I think we get stuck, Brian, all the time as humans, don't you think, in various versions of ourselves, thinking that's as far as we need to go in life or who we are fully.
I couldn't agree more. Something that I've been kind of contending with, and I won't say struggling with because that's not the right language to use, but definitely something I've been contending with over the last 4 or 5 years is, where is my identity wrapped up in? And I bring it back to, I used to be a bodybuilder. Like, now I do lots of ultramarathons and triathlon and things along those lines. But when I was bodybuilding, I was in that echo chamber of other people who did bodybuilding. And it was right. Just confirmation bias, us against the world. And my identity was wrapped in that. And then what I found for me, it really impacted my happiness level, because I had my identity way too much wrapped up in this person who I thought I was. And then as soon as that got challenged, I got very defensive, and that repeated over and over again made me feel really unhappy. And that kind of gives me a nice little segue into what I want to talk about, because I know there's lots of people who, I talk about purple polar bears. So, the example that if you walk down the street and somebody says you're a purple polar bear, you kind of just go, okay, and you forget about it 2 minutes later. Whereas if somebody says, you're fat or you're ugly or you're stupid, that could sit with you for a day, a week, a month, even longer. And I'm like, well, why did one comment bother you and the other didn't? And it's like, because your identity is wrapped up in it. Paul, talk about changing your identity through repetition.
I think one of the things I moved into in light of this conversation some years ago was being much more interested and curious about the soul, the human soul. Out of it came a seminar I did around the world, and now it's an online video course called The Prosperity of the Soul. And what I learned from that, one of the main things I take away from that relevant to your question, is that most of us, most of the planet, are living from an egoic identity. So the ego attached to the bodybuilding world, as you said, or the ego attached to my religious world, or the ego attached to my status, or my background, or my nationality, or my gender or whatever it may be. I think what's happening that from birth, we grow up and we are nurtured into by people, parents, guardians, culture, that also, of course, is locked into its egoic identity and are blind spotted about that. So I think for me, 20 plus years ago, coming up into my midlife, I'm 64 in a week's time, but coming into my midlife in my early 40s, I didn't have the language I'm using now, but I realized looking back that my shifts were to move from an egoic identity, label-based identity, because I think labels are for packages. They are not for people. But from birth, and from before birth, we are smothered and buried in layers of labels. These labels become our identities. We didn't choose them. We often don't know where they came from. They're inherited. Some of them, of course, are we're born into. We're born British, or we're born white, or we're born rich, or we're born poor. These politics, those politics, this religion, that religion. So before we're even born, we are having layers painted on us. And I think what I've tried to do and continue to work on daily is stepping away from my attachment to my egoic identity, so that I can get more in touch with the essence of myself, which is in the human soul. I believe the essence of who we are is in our soul identity. But most of us, as I say, don't know that, therefore don't live from that, or have moments where we step into it, but we don't know how to get back there.
I love that. Like one of the, again, very similar to, and I'm so glad we're having this conversation, that trying to remove yourself from your ego, and it's very easy to see where you're leaving from ego or where you're leading from ego. I'm like, you know, just watch your reactions. I'm like, watch your next three reactions to something happening, and you can see where your ego is coming from, because you tend to get angry or upset or mad because you've wrapped all your identity into, you know, the who you are as a person, and somebody's challenging that, or a belief system you hold, a religion, a you know, nationality, whatever it is. And it's very easy to be us versus them, and you know, all that does is rob your own unhappiness, or robs your own happiness levels. How do you, Paul, you mentioned there kind of stepping away from the egoic identity. Like, what's your process for that? Is it meditation? Is it, you know, consuming information that just challenges that belief, in terms of, you know, I read a lot of Stoic philosophy and a lot of philosophy to kind of help me manage and work through that. What's your process for stepping away from that egoic, you know, egoic identity? Because I think that's really useful for people, especially for those who are trying to reframe or frame the way they see problems or frame the way they see the world, so that it's more supportive for them going forward.
I think for me, Brian, and I think this is more common than we talk about. I think for me, it was unhappiness and stuckness. I think sometimes we need a crisis that bumps us into ourselves, or the self that we don't like and is not working for us. I think for me, it was coming to a continual season of unhappiness and stuckness, which then begins to affect your health and your sleep and your relationships, and so on. And I think it was a wake-up call to me. Now, many people have versions of what I just said, and they don't all, of course, move to an inward journey. They, of course, sometimes, you know, wallpaper over that, concrete over that, as it were, by distraction and doing other things, only to bump into it again or two or ten later. I think for me, because I was coming into midlife in my early 40s, I think I was paying more attention to the possibility of the language around midlife crisis stuff. And was this something I should be more thorough about than just, you know, buying a sports car or getting a pink hairdo or whatever, and trying to sort of distract myself through my midlife? And so I went inward. And so the study you mentioned, the research, the reading, the learning, the listening, the open-mindedness came later, after I realized that I was stuck. And I didn't want to, you know, blow past that by just being distracted, buying stuff, having more vacations, trying more different things. I think a lot of people do versions of that when what's shouting at them from inside is, please pay attention to which part of you you are living from. That was my beginning of my awareness that I needed to move from being so governed by my ego to listening and settling and calming down into a more rhythmic flow that felt effortless, by living from my soul, which isn't striving for anything. There's a wonderful quote that I use that Jesus said, and other religious leaders through history have said versions of this. He said, what does it profit a person if they gain the whole world but lose their soul? And I think what he's talking about there is a dual identity. When he's talking about the part of you that wants to gain the world, he's not talking about your soul, because your soul doesn't want to gain anything. Your ego does. And I think he's speaking about the egoic identity in modern day language, I would use now, and the soul identity. And I think in the world, we are so driven by gaining, the gaining part of us, the drive to gain and to have and to become and to possess is the ego. And the part of you that doesn't want to do any of that and is scared of letting go of that, the healthy part of you is the soul, and the ego is battling to keep that suppressed because the ego is terrified that you would ignore it and do something different today. And that's where my journey began, Brian. It was a wake-up call to me of feeling stuck. And I think a lot of people that have versions of that, however mild or severe my encouragement is, to pay attention to that, don't you think? Pay attention to it. Don't brush past it. Pay attention to it, because it's something inside you calling to you to wake up.
Yeah, the high end of, you know, what you resist will persist. Like, I have to remind myself of that consistently when things come up and I realize, oh, I better deal with it now or else it's just going to come up again in 2 or 3 years and be 10 times worse. You know, Jordan Peterson's quote, don't hide monsters under the rug, like, because they just feed and get bigger. But I'm very curious, Paul, with, you mentioned there kind of the midlife crisis and people, I think there's the quarter life crisis as well that people are familiar with in terms of the, they hit 24, 25, and like, what do I do now? The same as the midlife crisis. But as somebody that's done so much internal work, and what I'm hearing you say is that you're turning it inward. And I think that advice for me, for everybody listening, is so useful that yes, you can have the distractions of the external world and you can buy this and you can do that and you can look this way. But unless you fix what's going on internally, you know, you can put a new person into a new car, but it'll be the same person inside, just in a new car. Or, you know, one of the quotes I'll use for weight loss for a lot of people that listen to this podcast, I'm like, losing weight solves all your weight loss problems. It doesn't solve all your problems though. And I think it's important for people to realize that the external things that you're doing aren't necessarily going to make you feel internally any better. Like, if you're unhappy and you lose weight, there's no guarantee that losing 10 pounds is going to make you happier. It just means you'll weigh 10 pounds less on a scale. And I think turning that inward is important. But with that either midlife crisis or even quarter life crisis for some people, Paul, what do you wish you had known in, say, your even late 20s or early 30s that you know now?
Well, I think I'd listened to a podcast. I think I wish I'd listened to a podcast like this one that we're doing now, Brian. I think I wish I'd come across someone that was speaking about this in a way that was accessible. I think the language of ego and soul and human flourishing has so been shrouded in mystery and complex language that most of us feel it's inaccessible, or it's for those kind of new age out there people that read those kind of books and are sitting cross-legged meditating somewhere on a mountain. And because we feel that's not ordinary enough, we don't access it. We know it's out there. And I think conversations like we're having now for your listeners, I'm trying to make this practical and accessible, because I know for me, it had to become like that. And because one of my primary gifts is making things simple, becomes that eventually. It doesn't mean when I found it, or when I read the book, or when I've had a conversation or listened to a speaker about it, it was simple. I feel like I'm a human transformer. I have to step it down into the currency of normal people for this to become accessible. It really bothers me, as I know it does lots of your listeners, I guess, Brian, and you too, that when it comes to modern medicine, we are still not holistic in our approach. You know, I do personal mentoring. A lot of people I mentor are in the medical world, and it's a huge frustration to them that they are daily writing prescriptions for physical symptoms, but they know that the symptoms are not caused physically. They're not treating the root. So people are on a prescription medication path for decades, which has its own complications, but they are not getting well, because the doctors know that what's causing them to have physical symptoms that they're treating, of anxiety or stress-related illnesses or blood pressure and so on and so on. I think it's something like I read the other day, and I think it's not exaggerated. 85% or more of what takes us to the doctor are stress-related illnesses, but we're treating the symptom, not the stress. And I think I'm longing for, whether I'll see it in my lifetime or not, I don't know, for the more holistic approach. So we're not going to the doctor for our body, the psychiatrist for our brain, the psychologist for our mind, the church for our spirit, the gym for our body. Somewhere we need to bring all of these pieces together so that we treat humans in a holistic way. As you said, and with your fitness mindset book, you've come to discover and figured out, thank God, that, as you say, you can go to the gym and have a great body and look great for your Instagram selfies. But if you are toxic inside, harboring regret, forgiveness, and bitterness and anger, you're still not going to age well and probably die before your time of illnesses related to that inner toxicity. Everybody's surprised because you're so fit and healthy and do triathlons, but you're miserable all the time and you're unhappy. And that inner toxicity is what's killing you. And no one's talking about that enough.
So you've given me a kind of a perfect kind of level into what I want to talk on now. I think of, you know, Western medicine and symptomatic treatment. Now, I'm all for Western medicine. I go into a car crash, I want to go to a hospital to get fixed. Like, I don't want somebody waving over some bioenergetics on me when I've been in a car crash. But when I think of symptomatic treatment, I think of, you know, you can't paint, you know, dead leaves tree and then say paint leaves on a tree that's dead green and say that it's alive. I'm like, you have to look at it holistically. But you mentioned there about, you know, the perfect body or a good body and toxicity inside. Like, I always think back to when I was competing in bodybuilding, especially Instagram, because that's when I started posting on Instagram first, and I was putting up the selfies and the competitions and the photo shoots and traveling around the world. And I was the most stressed, the most anxious, the most unhappy I think I've ever been in my life. But you had never would have known that from social media. You know, I use it like the analogy, like the Wizard of Oz, that I was making sure that everyone saw that it was Oz, but I was the sweaty man behind the curtain, but nobody saw that, you know. And you choose to put up on social media what you want people to see, and I think that's really important to break that down for people so that, you know, comparison syndrome doesn't make them unhappy, that they're at least comparing themselves against themselves.
I saw that Wizard of Oz post on your Instagram the other day. I thought it was great, brilliant, depicting what it is you're trying to say to us. And again, I think what you just described of the Instagram and the selfies is the ego. Again, we're back to the ego, that so much of social media, as we know, is driven by the ego's need to present a certain image of us that we're terrified people will find out is not the real us. And I think what social media has done, as it's facilitated the viral nature of that now around the world, so many more of us, and I'm concerned about the emerging generation who are growing up unlike I did. They're growing up in that kind of culture that we talked about now. So for them and I watch my grandkids, I have 8 grandkids. My grandkids are so savvy in all of this already. And my granddaughters are so aware of all this and TikTok and all that. And the image that's out there by their peers already, you know, before they're even 10, they're into it. And I worry about, you know, where that goes in the future. I know it's bad enough now, but these kids have been born into it. And again, it is this reinforcing of this egoic identity of who you want to come across as. And it is a disaster waiting to happen, because at some point it's going to crash and burn. And I don't know when they crash and burn. This is the other thing about holistic and developing a great internal ecosystem, is that falling down and crashing and burning is going to happen. But it's less fearful if you've got good getting back up skills. And a lot of human beings don't have good recovery skills. So when they crash and burn, it is much more severe than it needed to be, because they haven't developed an internal strength and internal growth to be able to recover from falling and failing. And so, as you said, it's the comment made down the road, you're fat or whatever, that becomes an internal trauma that can last for years, go underground. Because that happens so easily and so easily on social media with a troll comment, but the recovery process is not happening for many people. And I worry about all of that complexity that's going on. So I'm great we're having this conversation. Grateful that we are.
Yeah, me too. Like, one of the, again, I can't control how everything is going to go, but my daughter's going to be 6 in May, and like, I don't post her on my social media at all. She's not on my Instagram page at all. And partly because I'm trying to play a little bit of the long game as somebody that has a presence online and probably will in the next 10 years when she's a teenager. And I'll use it as a reference that, look, you're the most important person in my life. You're not even on my social media. Like, and using that nearly as a reference to be, you know, to play that long game, that think about what's important and then post and use social media and have a good relationship with it. But again, I might be wrong. Come back to me in 10 years. It might be completely the wrong approach. But it's one of the reasons for I doing it now. Paul, how do we develop getting back up skills? I think that's a really important thing for people. And you mentioned it. And I love that language. Can you expand on that a little bit for us?
I think one of the things I've enjoyed doing is reading biographies like Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, reading biographical stories, testimonials, podcasts, movies that are getting back up stories, and observing the skill set that was required in recovering from a fall, a failure, a setback, a disappointment, a disaster, whatever it may be. And it's out there. This stuff is out there. But I think often that's not what we're interested in. So I'm interested in how Richard Branson recovered from, you know, multiple bankruptcies. I'm interested how these people that we have on a pedestal, I'm interested in the behind the scenes version of themselves, because they do talk about that. But I think we're less interested in how they recovered from a setback than we are in their highlight reels. And I think what I became a student of is how people recover. And it's to do with paying attention to the things in yourself that got you in trouble. It's to do with how you view what got you there, how you view what being there means. It's to do with, again, how you manage shame and guilt that people put on you and you put on yourself when you go through a failure or a setback. It's all of that that I become a student of. And I think somewhere in all of that is enough tools to recover and get back up from almost anything. And I know, you know, lots of your listeners have been through lots of stuff. I don't want to say that and minimize anybody's pain that they're going through right now. But I have become a student of pain and suffering, my own and others, and realized that that the human species are the only species on the planet that store pain. All other species don't do that. And that's because we are blessed and we are cursed with things called self-consciousness and self-awareness. No other species have that blessing or affliction as it is for most of us. So I think it's figuring out, as you talk in your mindset teaching, Brian, that so much of my mindset is keeping me down. And if I don't change my mindset, I will stay down longer than I and my recoveries will be slower and more drawn out, because my mindset is crippling me more than the event crippled me.
Wow, that's so powerful. I just need to let that sit for a second. Like, again, a student of suffering, storing pain, like the only species that does that. I think that's just powerful language.
Yeah, because when a zebra is attacked by a lion, or the lion is chasing the zebra, it's fascinating to watch it on a nature show. Because you see the chase, and either the lion gets it and kills it, or the zebra escapes to run or fight another day. But, you know, a few minutes later, the zebra's just got his head down grazing. It's not living in the trauma of what just happened. And we do. And we humans store that moment for years or for a lifetime. And the pain builds up inside us, becomes a pain body. And I think it's that. And I think when that happens, you stay down longer because the burden of the remembered pain is keeping you down. You might want to change. You might want a lighter life. You might want an off-ramp from this entrapment that you're in. But this storing of pain, and what happens is too, Brian, I think, and I found this in my own life, pain loves company. So you find a pain echo chamber. And now you find people with similar trauma to you. That can be a good thing to do. But sometimes we gather around each other's pain and keep each other there. That's why I think, you know, things like AA, the recovery program, is good, because it pushes you, kicks you up the butt if you are in self-pity and parking up. I was going to say to you that I was talking the other day to someone I was chatting to that is a recovering alcoholic. And his sponsor says to him, he said, I called my sponsor a few months ago and said, you know, I'm panicking. I had a drink. I feel terrible. He was battling shame and guilt and not getting back up. And he would have stayed in that depression for a long time. And he said, my sponsor said to me, as he said before, okay, here's what you're going to do. Go to the gym, work out for an hour, then call me back. And the guy said to me, every time I do that, the exercise itself became a lifesaver. Because after I've been to the gym, then I called him back. I felt less panicky. I felt more open-minded. I felt more capable of recovering. Just something as simple, and you know about this, Brian, of movement of the body, of the discipline of exercise, a simple thing like that can be, as you know, a recovery tactic.
I think it's one of the most underutilized aspects of exercise is that grounding, for sure.
There you go.
Paul, you mentioned there shame and guilt, and I want to kind of focus on that because I know there's a lot of people listening who this will be the kind of catalyst that gets them looking and turning it inward. And there's going to be lots of people, probably the 70%, maybe more, who know that they've got guilt, know that they've got shame. They know they've got something internal that's holding them back. You talk a lot about in like the solution mindset, you know, your course, you talk about this on your channels about framing and the way you see a problem. Do you think when it comes to, say, particularly shame and guilt, but any strong emotion that is either slightly traumatic or something that's triggered us, do you think framing is the starting point, or reframing how we see it is the starting point towards moving away from the pain, the stored pain? Or do you think it's the entire situation is can be fixed from reframing? What's your kind of take on that and using reframing? Because I know you open your solution mindset course with this. Like, what's your kind of viewpoint in terms of, in particular, to things like shame and guilt?
Yeah, I think as early as in my, you know, mid-teens, late teens, early 20s, I was aware of these inherited fixed mindsets that I became aware I'd never chosen. I didn't put them there. I didn't construct them. And I think it began early on as clumsily. As I began to do this without knowing what I was doing, I began to ask myself, why do I do that? I remember one day, and I had three kids by the time I was 20, my wife and I, because we had twins when we were 19, and our oldest was four by then. I remember being around the kids one day, and my wife had said to me, which she said many times, why are you so irritable and angry all the time with the kids, so short-tempered? And whereas before my ego had pushed that away and been defensive and given reasons for that, because I'm working hard and I'm exhausted and, you know, anybody out there with twins knows what I'm talking about. I didn't sleep for about 3 years. Instead, on that day, I said to her, I don't know. I don't know seems a cop-out answer, but genuinely, there are so many things we say and do and are triggered by and ought to respond in an autopilot way to, and the answer genuinely is, I don't know why the hell I react like that, do that, behave like that, say that, feel that. And that's what I began to ask myself, where's that come from? And I realized that a lot of this came from a framing I had had put on me, I inherited. And the thing is about parents, there's no villains here. Every parent does the best they can. But if parents have not done the work themselves that we're talking about here, then it gets generationally passed on. So a faulty frame that I have, I pass on to my kids without knowing I did that. So if I am racist, or if I am in some way discriminatory or prejudiced, or I'm threatened in some way by certain types of people, or I have certain mindsets about generosity or health or whatever, I am going to, by default, pass that on, not knowing that my kids inherited a framing. So when they face a challenge in their life around that area, all they have to default to is the frame that contains their options. And I think what I began to do, and I've done intentionally for 20 odd years now, much more intentionally, is questioning, where does that mindset come from? Is that serving me well? And how do I deconstruct it? So I've become a big fan and advocate in recent years. I've done a lot of teaching on the art of unlearning. Unlearning is the most underestimated part of learning, because we're constantly trying to put new things on top of old things. And the old things are so shaky and so unreliable And so the new things never benefit us because we are not decluttering and we're not getting rid of all the debris of the stuff we should have got rid of years ago so that the new things become as beneficial as they could be. And I think it's that. And you know from your fitness regime, Brian, that you have to build on a foundation, don't you, in order for what you did in the gym today to benefit you. It has to be built on some basic foundational principles of fitness and approach that requires a mindset.
I'm going to ask a question when it comes to the art of unlearning, because I think that's such a powerful concept to people. I always think of it's just you have so much bandwidth in your mind and the way you see things that you have to, it's easier to remove the unsupported belief systems. Like the example I use, you know, when it comes to food for people is, you know, separating food into good and bad categories. I'm like, that's fine if you're 5 years old, but that belief system isn't very helpful if you're 25, 35 or 45. You know, but I'm very curious, Paul, as someone that works with so many people, and you've done so many talks and between courses and all the hundreds and thousands of people you've served over the years, when it comes to unlearning, I'm not going to ask how to unlearn something, but I'm going to ask kind of a selfish question as someone who's currently in the process of struggling with this. Why do you think we are so reluctant to let go of the things that we know aren't going to serve us anymore, even though we know it's an unserving belief system? And what I mean by that is over the last 6 months, anger is something that I've been really trying to bring up and let go of. But there's something, my ego, something is just not letting me get rid of it in certain areas towards specific people, towards specific things that have happened to me in the past. And I know my life would be greatly served if I removed it. You know, it's the Buddha quote that hating somebody else or having anger towards somebody else is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. But not being able to let go of that. From your experience, what do you think makes us hold on to that? Is it an ego thing? Is it a, you know, we're so afraid of what might happen? Is it that we're afraid of our unlimited potential? What has been your experience with that for people who are struggling to let go of things or unlearn things that they know their life would be better if they just got rid of it?
Well, definitely ego is involved with something like anger, isn't it? Or our version of masculinity. I had a very bad version of masculinity handed to me, you know, by my dad. I don't blame him because I think, you know, generationally, that's what he inherited. So, you know, my family of six of us, you know, four boys, two girls, we inherited a very bad framing of that. So that becomes, again, your egoic identity as a kid. So that's in the mix, yeah. But I think one of the reasons we hold on to things that we know are not serving as well is two things. One, we're not sure what's next that's better than that. Because if what you're holding on to has served you to some degree well for years, or it's been even a protection mechanism, i.e. the ego, it's reluctant to let that go when you're not sure what to replace it with. I think the other thing is, if parts of our identity that we know are not working for us, if we were taught them by people that are respected and they're still in our lives, it's hard to change parts of your identity and behavior and habits if they are attached to a sense of respect and honor that you have for the people that taught you that. So, and I've had to in my life realize that I know that the person that taught me this was a good person and loved me and I respected them, but I now know it was wrong. I didn't know it was wrong then because I wasn't that version of me to be aware. This wasn't a good thing to teach me. So it wasn't that they were wrong in teaching me. They did the best they could, like all of us are doing at this time. But I think I realized one of the reasons I struggled to step away from it and deconstruct it was that when people around me saw me reacting differently and saying and speaking differently to what I was taught, and often they were taught from the same person, a mentor or a coach or a leader, an influential figure in our lives, they were like, that's interesting. I never heard you say that before. You know, what do you think so-and-so would think of you responding that way? It could be your mother, could be your dad, could be a sibling, could be, you know, anyone in your life. And I think the fear of upsetting that person keeps you in some version of what you know not's working. And what I found was this, when I was around the person that taught me the thing I needed to get free from, I dumbed it down. I didn't want to upset them. Because when they were trotting out the same thing again to others in the room, that I thought, no, you did this to me 20 years ago. Don't tell it to these new people. I wanted to rescue them. but I dumbed it down out of respect to the person that taught me it. I think it's that versions of that make us cling to things because we respect our mum, our dad, our friends, our family, our leaders, our mentors, whoever, but they were wrong. It's never served them well either, actually, when you examine it. I think it's part of that too. I don't know what's next, so I'm clinging on to this. My ego is protected if I keep doing it, keeps this identity of me intact. And I don't know who's going to be offended or upset if I now step up and say this. And in my case, on social media, want to post something like on racism and so on that I've done over the last few years. I had a post that went viral on interrupting a racist joke. I know I'm going to get a lot of crap come back at me from people that whose frame has been challenged and whose mindsets have been challenged. And if they speak, as it were, they know people around them will give them a hard time because it threatens everybody's egoic identity of whatever it is I'm touching on. So I think it's complicated to let go of what's not working, even though you know it's not working.
It's so interesting. What came up for me there as well is when I think of that, when I think of in my particular case, which might be useful for people listening, is it kind of comes down to a self-worth issue. Like I always think that the anger that I'm trying to let go of now in my early 30s was something that was very serving for me in my mid-20s. It allowed me to, you know, use that fuel for fire. It allowed me to disconnect from people. It allowed me to set up a business. It allowed me to do all these physical challenges and things that I've been able to do because I was fueled by that anger. But after a certain point, similar to separating food into good and bad categories when you're 5 years old versus 25, 35 or 45, some of those belief systems just aren't helpful anymore. And that really help me, Paul, what you said, because I need to definitely check back in with that at the end of this podcast.
And I think what happens, Brian, is, you know, so you, that energy that you called anger, and we all do that, and we used it in a good way, like you said, it's not that you lose that. You're not supposed to lose that energy. You just have to channel it different. So now it becomes, I think, your stage of life now and mine, that anger moves to becoming determination or stickability or perseverance or resilience. That's what it now becomes. And I think the raw versions of it, as you said, came out poorly and were anger or rage. I get how that serves people. But I think the more evolved you become and the more self-aware you become, I think the more you try to move away from that, not knowing, no, hang on, that energy served you well. It still will. It now needs refining to become a better version of the destructive version that you had.
Shows the power of language. Just that one reframe. Do you think language and the way we speak to ourselves, Paul, is as important as anything else?
I think language, you know, I am a wordsmith. Language is huge to me in my communication career. So yeah, I think finding the right language, saying a thing well, and I think as well, as you said in the bio, I think one of my go-to things for me now has become for years, why the hell do people make complex things more complex? And I think when we talked earlier and I said that, I think part of what I feel my calling is, my vocation is and passion is to make complex things simple, which is hugely dependent on finding accessible common language so we can all access something that has been hijacked by the elite for decades and kept there. And, you know, people like us, ordinary people like us that are not part of that elite group, whatever it may be, feel it's inaccessible to us. And so what I wanted to do is to, keep using language that if I can get it, I think anyone can get it, but I have to create a bridge through language, like I know you're doing all the time through your work, Brian, so that complex things that people really need to know, people really need to know this stuff, but it is still not mainstream available because it is not being put into mainstream everyday language. So it continues to be airy-fairy and out there and exclusive. And this stuff we're talking about now is a lifesaver. It is literally life-saving stuff. So why isn't this more mainstream in our world is what bothers me. So part of my campaign is to do that.
Yeah, and you're definitely doing it, Paul. And with that simple language, there's something I wanted to touch on because I think a lot of people will get value from this because a large portion of the audience that listen to this podcast are into their personal development in whatever sense, whether that's body compositional change or their mindset listening to a podcast like this. But talk about, and I loved this because I think it was on your Instagram or maybe you mentioned it in a podcast. It was definitely in something I was consuming in the lead up to this interview. Talk about how it's okay to outgrow people.
Yeah, I think this is again a biggie, you know, going back to you, why do we cling to things that are not working? Because leaving those things that are not working also means leaving the people who taught you it. That's really difficult. And that can be, you know, a spouse, it can be a partner, it can be a romantic relationship, it can be a friendship, it can be a family unit, it can be a town, a city, a culture, a job, a church, or whatever. I think sometimes that's the difficulty of these reinventions we're speaking about. But I've, you know, come to make peace with, it's okay to outgrow people. And every new version of you is going to involve leaving someone else behind. And one of the problems in life is the people who've known you the longest are the most resistant to you changing because they fear that if you change too much, they will not have the same space in your life. And so what happens is we become aware of, we are changing so fast, you know, that Phil is full of insecurity in his recent conversations with you, you know, or Jane is constantly trying to pull you back into, you know, old conversations and old joke telling and old energies and atmospheres. And you now so hate being around those conversation atmospheres, but it's hard for you to explain why you don't want to be in the WhatsApp group anymore because you're fed up of the drama. But you used to love the drama. You were part of it. And that's what I mean. You move to new versions of you, more enlightened, awake versions of you. And if the people that have known you the longest are not doing the same work as you, the same journey as you, life is filled with you constantly outgrowing people. And it's okay. It's not comfortable. It's not easy. But what I believe is that there is another group of people waiting for every new version of you who you'll never meet if you stop. If you stop and park up on the old crowd because it's more comfortable and familiar, though you know it's a bad fit, then the people that are waiting to meet the new version of you around the corner, you'll never meet because you stayed in a half-baked version of the old you, the new you. And millions of us and organizations, businesses, political parties do that. They get stuck in a Frankenstein version of who they could have evolved to become. It's bits from everywhere, but they're never evolving to become this new identity. And I've done that in my life. And I think I'm encouraging people, I think in answer to that, Brian, to be okay with outgrowing relationships, and new relationships will find you, but they can't if you stay in an old version of you for the sake of keeping people happy, which is really difficult, as again, if you all your life have been a people-pleasing kind of yes person, it's more difficult if that's how you're wired to do that too, I think.
Did you find, because I definitely did on my side, but I know individual experiences varied person to person. Did you find that it gets, as you keep continually growing, that it gets easier to outgrow people in combination with the people that are closest to you tend to stay in your life regardless because they accept your growth? What's been your experience with that?
Yes, I think it gets easier because you commit to it and you get this kind of awareness of, I need to commit to this for me. It's the most important thing, because the most important thing to you to keep evolving and growing rather than dancing to the tune of someone else's version of you. And I think, I don't know if it's a midlife awakening. I would love this to be an earlier life awakening, as you talked about earlier, the, you know, quarter life awakening. One of the things I wish in my youth I had heard was this conversation, because I was so many other people's versions of me. And I think you get to a stage of life where you think, this is why the midlife crisis language occurs, because you get to an awareness in your life, somewhere in midlife perhaps, hopefully sooner, that you are not living your life. You are living someone else's version of your life. And eventually, I think you get so fed up of that, of the damage it does and the unhappiness it breeds, because you finished it by this time in a career that you hate, that your parents pushed you into. You married to someone that you shouldn't because other factors pushed you into that union. You're living somewhere you don't want to, and so on and so on. And so you look around your life in midlife and think, this is not my life. And, you know, you get lots of shows on TV. I used to watch Oprah when she did her talk show, and she used to have versions of this on the show. I remember a guy that was a Microsoft executive in China, the equivalent of Bill Gates in the company, but in China, he was the Asia kind of guy, multimillionaire, coming into his late 40s and just got burnt out. And so went backpacking in the Himalayas and in those towns and villages there. While he was backpacking, comes across these schools, kids sit in benches in the dirt with no books, and gave him the books from his backpack that were, of course, not in their language, but they had pictures in. And these kids had never seen a book in their life, but these were adult books. And he promised to go back next year and backpack again and take kids' books, which he did. Long story short, he quit Microsoft, gave up his career at his prime, and started a charity to provide kids' books to these schools in Nepal, Himalaya, and so on, Tibet. And that's become his charity now for 20-odd years. And I think versions of that are what we all bump into because we realize, like he did, I am not this Microsoft executive. It's not who I am. How did I get here? So, yeah, I think we all have to start small, and that's where it begins, of realizing in that conversation today, I was not me. I surrendered. I played ball. I stayed inside their version of me. I didn't say no. I didn't say I don't accept that. I didn't disagree. I just fitted in. I think it's that the sooner you stop doing that in even miniature ways, micro ways, the easier it becomes not to do that as you age.
I love that. There's so much value, Paul. I've only got one final question. I've absolutely loved this conversation. We'll definitely do a round two at some stage if you're up for it. Paul, you put out a lot of stuff on Instagram. You've obviously got the podcast, social media presence. And I know you've been, you know, years, you know, three decades traveling around, working with people, speaking with people. And you have such a fantastic message, as I think everybody that's listening to this podcast in its entirety will get, because I'm going to be re-listening, because there's stuff you said there that I need to check back in with myself and just kind of challenge a couple of those beliefs that haven't been serving me up until now. But if you had access to Instagram or social media in general, say everybody that has an Instagram account, the, you know, X amount of billion of people that are into mindset, who are into personal development, and you could put one message out to those people on the Instagram platform, what would you say to them?
I know it's an older statement. It's not original to me, but I've heard versions of this. Be yourself. Everyone else is taken. Be yourself. I think it's that has been my go-to for now a couple of decades, that I want you to be you. Hence my last answer, to be yourself, not be someone else's version of yourself. And I think being yourself, saying that, is so easy. I just said it. But being yourself has been my life's work, and I think it will be your listeners too. So I know it's easy to say, I know it's a billboard and a clickbait, be yourself. But when I say that, I know what I mean by that is all the stuff we just talked about. But I know the cost of not being yourself is massive, including physical sickness, mental health, and so on and so on. And out of alignment with who you were supposed to be from birth. So my quest has been to introduce people back to the best version of themselves is, I think, my life's work at this stage of my life. So it will be somewhere around that, Brian. I will be shouting from the rooftops till the day I die. Be yourself. It costs, because until you are you, all this stuff you're looking for, happiness, fulfillment, joy, achievement, is going to elude you.
What a fantastic summary of the last 55 minutes or so of incredible content. Paul, thank you so much for this. For everybody that's listening, Paul, where is the best place for them to connect with you, to check out the Solution Mindset course? Is it through Instagram? Is it through the website? Where would you like to send people?
Yeah, Instagram, Paul Scanlon UK. My website is paulscanlon.com. And all the stuff we've talked about, Brian, is accessible either of those two places. Yeah. Thanks, mate. Appreciate this conversation. You are a great human. Thanks for all you're doing, Brian, in this space. It's so important what you're doing, mate, especially with the Fitness Mindset book. and your commitment to that part of our humanity, not just the, you know, physical stuff. Thanks for what you're doing in this space. I think it's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, mate. I really appreciate that, and I appreciate you. And for everybody listening, I will link everything Paul mentioned in the show notes on briankeenfitness.com and in the description wherever you listen to podcasts. So head over to Instagram, give him a follow, check out his content, check out the podcast, check out the website. Paul, thank you so much again. Keep spreading the amazing message, and thank you so much for this. This has just been an incredible conversation, so thank you.
Thanks, mate. Take care. Appreciate it.
So there you have it, Paul Scanlon on the art of unlearning, developing get up skills or get back up skills when life gets difficult, and why it's okay to outgrow people. Apologies for the mini therapy session clearly on this episode, but hopefully you got as much out of it as I did. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave a rating and review. That helps with the podcast and the algorithms on iTunes especially. And if it's your first time listening, hit that follow or subscribe button for new episodes coming every single Monday. That's everything for this week's episode. Catch you all next Monday. We'll be right back.